Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report and happy Labor Day. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up, we preview more of the upcoming Crop Consultant Conference, but today we start with Taylor Talstrom.
Hi, welcome to My Ag Life. Today we're talking with Brian Walbrink, co-owner of Sperry Farms Incorporated and chairman of Almond Board of California, about making the transition to off-ground almond harvest. Welcome, Brian.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate the time.
Yeah, great to have you here today. Brian, my first question for you here, off-ground harvest is part of Almond Board of California's 2025 air quality goals. Why is the Almond Board interested in the feasibility of off-ground harvesting?
You know, I think it's always good to look at where we're going in the industry. Although off-ground is not here today, and it's also not for everybody, it's really interesting to see the possibilities of off-ground. And I think that's what got the Almond Board very excited about looking at this as part of the Harvest Work Group. So it's a look forward, it's futuristic, and we're very excited to be talking about it.
What is some of the research currently being looked at by the Harvest Work Group, Brian?
We've had kind of an evolution of research with this work group. We really started with the feasibility on the ground, the measurement of dust. So we kind of got those things out of the way. We looked at the equipment. Now we're really on to the drying. We're really focused on the drying. Do we dry them in field? Do we dry them out of the field? I think that's the current snapshot of where the group's at today.
Brian, I just want to get your opinion on something. You know, as far as the work that the Almond Board has done with this research up to this point, do you foresee those 2025 air quality goals being met on time?
You know, I think we're in a good direction right now. You know, we have a few years left, but there's already been enormous progress. And I think just the industry talking about this as a whole is already a big win. We've already seen a dramatic dust reduction just from the equipment and from some of the evolution from the manufacturers. And I think this is such an important topic to have as farmers that we've already seen some huge gains in the first few years.
Being a chairman of the Almond Board now, what is the Almond Board, you know, planning on doing in the future to kind of get more of this off-ground harvest information out there to growers?
I think the Almond Board's role is really to be, you know, the discussion point and to bring groups that are interested in this concept forward, bring them together and kind of in this idea sharing collaboration way. We've had great participation from all the major manufacturers of almond equipment in this work group, but I think just getting the minds together and really having the discussion. This is our big event of the year. It's a one-shot deal. You know, it's 2 months, you know, very intense, very hot, very laborious for the growers, and really just notes and seeing what other people are doing, what's working, what's not working. And I feel like in farming, it's always easy to identify what's not working sometimes as it is to figure out what is working.
My next question for you here, off-ground harvesting has worked successfully in other nut crops and in almonds in other countries. Why is off-ground harvesting so complicated for California almond growers?
I think the size of us, I was fortunate enough to take a trip to Israel, and they're 90% off ground in the whole country, but you know, they're 15 to 20,000 acres. We're well over 1 million acres here in California. It was very interesting to see how their industry has wrapped their hands around off ground. But the number one point in the orchard is the tree height. So when you get to kind of the limbs of the tree, you have to have almost 3 feet in there. Most of the California orchards are anywhere from 18 to 24 inches. So actually getting all of that equipment underneath the canopy is a feasibility issue. So I think you really have to start kind of planning this from the orchard side when you're putting the orchard in. And it's kind of this, you know, back and forth, push, pull, where the industry's at, you know, if I'm ready to make the dedicated plant for off-ground harvesting. So there's a lot of different variables, but I think that's the number one factor.
Do you, you know, maybe foresee in the future, you know, you say that Israel, you know, they got like 90% of the acres doing off-ground harvest. Do you foresee the California almond industry getting to that point, or maybe it even becoming a requirement to do off-ground harvesting at one point?
I think it's a case-by-case basis. You know, we supply 85% of the world's almonds here over the course of California. So it's a very, you know, geographically concentrated area, but we're dealing with a lot of different factors. So behind me is one of our ranches. We're actually harvesting in this moment, which is really funny for the timing. But, you know, we see a lot of foothills back here. So you have foothill harvest, you have flat harvest, you have big trees, small trees. So there's so many different variables. I think it's a case by case basis. It would be great if the industry could achieve maybe a 50% off ground in 10 years kind of thing. So it's a longer term, longer reach goal.
Brian, what really needs to happen before growers can begin making the transition to off-ground harvesting?
I think they have to have the confidence in the research. I think they have to see other success stories in off-ground harvesting, which is where the Almond Board comes in. You know, they're very good at highlighting successful stories if growers are willing to share their secrets. So it's such a huge cost investment, especially with the equipment you already have as a grower. I'm saying I already have all of this harvesting equipment, so you're saying I can't use this anymore. So there's an equipment reach, but there's also that, you know, that futuristic planting. You know, an orchard is a 25 to 30 year investment. So if I'm going to start planning towards off ground harvest, I really have to make sure the tree's a little bit taller so we can get everything underneath it. So I think you just have to give the growers confidence that this is something that does work. It could be a great cost saver. And when you really think about it, you know, if your harvest was kind of a one-stop shop, you know, one machine came through, took the almonds out and out of the field, man, it's really nice because this is a crazy time of year for us.
I respect you saying that a lot of growers, you know, are worried about making that transition. Do you think there might be any sort of maybe incentive program in the future to kind of get more growers on par with off-ground harvest, like some of these other organizations do, with maybe incentives for cover crops, that type of thing?
Yeah, there already has been some great incentives for almond growers up and down the state through air boards. And it's really focusing on dust reduction. It's focusing on harvester upgrades. So I think any sort of incentive package that could be attached to off-ground harvesting, where it's a cost split, you get a giant credit if you upgrade, kind of thing like our tractor programs through the air boards. Yeah, definitely. It'd be a huge help. The machines are very costly. And like I said, to make that big investment, you really have to have the confidence this is where you're going.
Brian, I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier, that right now, a lot of the focus, at least for the board, is on mechanical drying. So mechanical drying versus allowing nuts to dry on the ground does raise questions, again, about cost and capacity. Brian, you know, are there any alternatives to mechanical drying being explored right now for off-ground harvest?
Absolutely. I think what's really important, which we've defined at the group level, off-ground harvest is simply means the almonds are not coming in contact with the ground, which is very important because there is a approach that can be taken that some companies are working on. And it's a shake and catch and a redirect. And like they grow or dry other commodities, if there was a paper or a surface laid in the tree row and the almonds and the whole shells, kernels laid on top of that, you're still off ground harvesting. So I think, you know, using our fields for drying, I think 100% is the best way to do it on a large scale. What Israel actually does, they will catch the almonds, take the almonds out of the field, and then take it to a drying location, and they'll put it back on the ground somewhere else. And looking at the feasibility, you can't really do that in California with the acreage size. So really, you got hot temperatures, you have nice airflow. So I think utilizing the middle of the tree row is probably the biggest win for the industry.
Kind of utilizing those rows instead of, you know, mechanical, those energy cost savings are probably going to be fairly substantial, I imagine.
Yeah. And just, and on the feasibility of that, right? I mean, there's only so many dryers in the state. And, you know, when you're looking, the kernel is anywhere from 20 to 30% of the total weight of the product. So really, like, looking at throwing all that into a dryer on a large scale, it doesn't seem to me, and it might to others, it might seem like that could be a good thing. But for me, to get widespread adoption, I think we got to use what God's given us out here. I think the heat, the sun, the air, I think if we can dry them out here, we're going to be way ahead.
Yeah, good sentiment. Brian, my last question for you here. Do you have any other thoughts for almond growers that are maybe looking to transition to off-ground harvest here in the future?
Get involved. Get involved with Almond Board, show up to the meetings. Our meetings are open. Share secrets, hear from other people who are doing this. And it's kind of, you know, become part of the fun. You know, I think everybody's having a really good time being innovative when you can. And just join us on the journey.
Perfect. Well, Brian, thank you for being available today and coming out from the orchard to talk about off-ground harvest day. Really appreciate some of those sentiments there and some of the advice for that transition. We appreciate having you on today.
Yeah, thanks for the time. Appreciate it.
Perfect. This is Taylor with My Ag Life.
The Crop Consultant Conference returns live in person on September 16th and 17th in Visalia, California. Co-hosted by Progressive Crop Consultant Magazine and the Western Region Certified Crop Advisors Association, this must-attend conference features 2 days of educational seminars, a live trade show, and honorariums and scholarships given by Western CCA, including the CCA of the Year Award. Hear the top experts in their field speak on pest management, artificial intelligence and new technologies, as well as the latest on soil health, nitrogen, and irrigation management. DPR and CCA credits will be available over the 2 days. For more information on credits, topics, and registration, visit progressivecrop.com/conference. The California Walnut Board and Commission provides value to the California walnut industry by working together with growers and handlers to advance the industry. Together, the California Walnut Board and Commission are helping to protect, develop, and grow California walnuts domestically and internationally. The California Walnut Board provides funding and strategic direction on walnut production and post-harvest research designed to help support the industry and promote California walnuts. To learn more, visit our website at walnuts.org. Together we grow. Agromiora Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromiora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromiora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
As we continue previewing the upcoming Crop Consultant Conference, we have for you one of the sponsors, SQM.
My name's John Allen. I'm the Western North America Sales Manager for SQM North America.
All right. Well, let's start out. Tell me a little bit about SQM.
So SQM is at our core, we're a Chilean-based mining company. Our headquarters exists in Santiago, Chile, and we have mining rights in the northern portion of Chile in the Atacama Desert. The Atacama Desert's the driest desert in the world. We're a global company. We have offices throughout the world. And our products as well are shipped throughout the entire world, North America, Asia, Europe, Australia, and obviously South and Central America. SQM, I mean, so we have two different divisions, we'll call it, for simplistic purposes. One is our industrial division. Our industrial division produces primarily lithium and iodine. I'm on the fertilizer side. SQM is basic in the three main potassium sources, potassium chloride, potassium sulfate, and potassium nitrate. We consider potassium nitrate our bread and butter, and it's really what we're out talking about the most. We also do water-soluble NPK blends and have multiple production facilities throughout the world, and we also have an organic line as well.
So in your position, you cover a very wide territory. Tell me about some of the things that you encounter. Are there certain issues that growers or PCAs are seeing and they come to you for solutions?
Yeah, so I do cover a large area, and we kind of dabble in most states. My territory is west of the Mississippi. So for example, in the Pacific Northwest, customers or potato growers in particular are looking for a product that's very, very soluble, which potassium nitrate is. In California, we see salinity issues, potassium nitrate has a relatively low salt index, and it could also be blended with a lot of different materials. I guess a benefit of potassium nitrate is the fact that it is 100% available to the plant, whereas there are other K sources that may not be 100% available. So really, I think what we've seen in the West recently is adaptation of potassium nitrate in all three grades, the crystalline form, the prilled form, and the liquid form. And dealers or growers are liking the versatility and some of the things that they can do to it compared to other potassium sources.
So at the upcoming Crop Consultant Conference, your company is one of the sponsors, and I believe you're sponsoring a speaking session.
We are.
What is that topic going to be on?
The topic is basically going to be a non-commercial presentation based on potassium nitrate and its benefits. And how potassium nitrate can fit in virtually any fertility program. It's the presentation itself is, I'd say, more on a little on the technical side, but it also puts potassium nitrate in practice as well. We're going to talk a little bit about utilizing liquid potassium nitrate. We're going to talk about briefly salt index, solubility, the three different grades, as well as the versatility of just potassium nitrate in general.
So it sounds like there will be a lot of information for people to learn through that session.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, potassium nitrate's been used in western half of the United States for a while now, but it really has been in the shadows of other potassium products. And so my time with SQM has been basically educating growers and PCAs on the benefits of potassium nitrate. As again, I keep saying versatility, but we think the versatility portion of potassium nitrate is a great benefit. So really the presentations that we have created are based on educating folks, because a lot of growers, PCAs, aren't fully aware of potassium nitrate and its uses.
Will you also have a booth at the conference?
We will. We will. A large, hopefully an end cap booth. Yep.
All right. So what are some of the things that you're hoping to talk with people about at your booth?
Again, it really goes back to education. A lot of growers still aren't familiar with potassium nitrate. There will be several of us in the booth. Our global agronomist will actually be in the booth as well. And his job really is education. And in the booth itself, we'll get probably some very specific questions on utilizing potassium nitrate in liquid form. That is definitely a new application that hasn't really been around for very long. And so that is where a lot of our conversations tend to lead is using potassium nitrate in liquid form and injected in all crops across California.
The Crop Consultant Conference is September 16th and 17th at the Visalia Convention Center. For more information, you can go to myaglife.com and click on the link in the top left corner. We'll be right back.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Hi, welcome to My Ag Life. Today we're talking with Priscilla Rodriguez, Director of Regulatory Affairs and Food Safety at Western Agricultural Processors Association, about a new proposal to mandate electric forklifts for the ag industry. Welcome, Priscilla.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, great to have you here today. Priscilla, my first question for you here. California Air Resources Board, or CARB, recently announced the next iteration of their large spark ignited regulation for forklifts, which is known as Forklift Rule 2.0. What does this new proposal potentially entail for the ag industry?
Absolutely. So this is, like you mentioned, this is the second iteration. So this is Forklift 2.0, as it's known, or really the large spark ignited regulation is what the official title is, but Forklift 1.0. We, in agriculture, little history, I guess, to go backwards, we were treating it a little bit differently when the initial rule came out, and there was a couple of reasons for that. But we were given different timelines and a different emissions factors to have to meet because of three things. One being that ag operations only operate seasonally, typically 3 to 4 months of the year. We are unable to pass along costs from these purchases of these expenditure costs from purchasing forklifts. And additionally, for those that use rough terrain forklifts, the technology simply does not exist for those lower emissions at the time to go any lower than what was provided to us. So we had a different timeline, and we had different emission levels that we had to meet. Now, this time around, what they're saying is they want to do electric across the board. The mandate would be for everybody. Everybody would be treated equally. So potentially that would entail everyone in agriculture would be required to have electric forklifts, regardless of their operation, regardless of their size.
Just comparing the original rule to this new rule, you know, you said they made some exceptions for agriculture in that old rule, but they've kind of, in a way, tossed out those exceptions now. Why have they moved in that direction, do you think?
So, and I mean, this is in line with what the administration is just going to, right? So there's been this recent push to do all electric in vehicles. There was the earlier this year, COVID kind of mixes everything up in my head. I don't know if it was earlier this year or last year, where they talked about the vehicle mandate by 2035, all vehicles would be electric. So it's definitely the administration's push to go that route. So that's hence why we see forklifts going in that way as well. So that's the difference. Now, we are working with CARB to educate them on the reasons why ag operations were treated differently in the past. And for the reasons I stated earlier, we were treated differently because we weren't able to meet those mandates. It's not cost effective for ag operations, right? When you're only running 3 to 4 months of the year, your equipment is sitting there for 8 to 9 months out of the year. So it's not doing anything. There's no way to pass along those costs. I mean, if we were a warehousing operation running 12 months out of the year, that makes sense. You can break that down over time, right? And the cost doesn't seem so significant, and they have the ability to pass along those costs, and we simply don't have that ability.
Priscilla, you know, CARB now wants, you know, like I said, to treat the ag industry the same as these other manufacturing operations, and you kind of just went into it a little bit, but why is that really problematic for certain producers, you know, like tree nut producers?
Right. So like I say, I touched on it a bit, but you think about an ag operation that runs 3 to 4 months of the year, and you think about another facility, say a warehouse facility that's working 12 months out of the year, 24 hours a day. Now, it's difficult to compare, right? It's not comparing apples to apples. It doesn't work that way. So to try to mandate something like that on producers who simply, it's simply not cost effective, right? Does it make sense to purchase it? It's like purchasing a vehicle yourself and just having it sit there for 8 or 9 months of the year. And it's not doing anything. It's not producing anything. Well, we only use it for 3 to 4 months of the year, and it's not producing anything any other time of the year. So to have that capital expenditure when we cannot pass along those costs, it doesn't make sense. It's not cost effective. And I mentioned to you earlier on the rough terrain. So specifically in the tree nut industry, the rough terrain forklifts are used just because of the rough terrain, right? So whenever you're driving on, say, like a warehouse, when you're driving on cement, something that's flat, it's easy to use electric equipment. when you're talking about out in rough terrain, hills, dirt, mud, gravel, you simply can't use electric forklift because it doesn't have the capability to do that, to maneuver in those areas. And rough, and right now, as it stands, rough terrain forklifts don't have that technology available. It doesn't exist. Now, at this last CARB meeting that happened, the CARB workshop, there was a manufacturer who said that they had this low emission forklift, a rough terrain forklift. So there's obviously, there's something that we can look into, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to work for the situation. So that has to be evaluated to see if it'll work.
They're looking into lower emissions, but that still isn't electric. Do you know of any manufacturers that are looking into electric, or is that just not really on the horizon?
Absolutely. No, that's just not on the horizon. Just for you think about the horsepower on a rough terrain is typically a lot higher than you're talking about your forklift. So it just simply does not exist. You'd have to imagine the amount of batteries you'd have to have. And it's similar to something like a tractor, right? If you wouldn't, how do you do a tractor, a forklift, electric tractor? You would need a trailer just with batteries to be able to operate. So it's simply just not feasible at the moment. Yeah.
We're going to be right back after a word from our sponsors.
Don't let your soils become tainted and unproductive from excess salts. Take care of your crops while caring for your soil. Cation X5 Plus by AgroPlanté is a soil conditioner meant to maximize water penetration by combating harmful salts in the soil, which can injure your crops and bottom line. Cation X5 Plus also corrects sulfur and calcium plant deficiencies. AgroPlanté wants to help you grow your crop. Contact us today to find out more at 559-498-0388 or visit us at www.agroplante.com.
Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
Hi, we're back talking with Priscilla Rodriguez, Director of Regulatory Affairs and Food Safety at Western Agricultural Processors Association, about a new proposal to mandate electric forklifts for the ag industry. Priscilla, CARB has also indicated that they believe it is actually cheaper to own and operate an electric forklift than a propane forklift. What evidence are they using to support that claim? And is it really accurate?
So that's a great question. So the information that CARB has used to substantiate this claim that electric is more cost effective than propane, they're using national data information. So yes, the information is accurate. They're using things like their sources are Electric Power Research Institute, American Electric Power, Propane Education Research Council. So the information shows that it's takes anywhere from 6 to 7 to 10 cents, basing it on a rate, electric rates of 6 to 10 cents per kilowatt hour. Now, that's a national average, which is correct. However, that is not correct for California. We are not based on the national average. It does not reflect what we pay in California. We pay amongst the highest electricity rates across the continental US. So wouldn't it be fair to use those numbers as a way to substantiate the fact that it would be more cost effective in California to operate electric versus propane? So when you think about that, when you make that analysis, you really have to look at what California is paying. And so what we did was we surveyed our membership to see what exactly are our members paying, what are the rates here in California? And from what we had, we seen anywhere from 14 cents per kilowatt hour all the way up to 35 cents per kilowatt hour. That's a huge difference from the numbers that they're using to substantiate that claim. So clearly that is part of the education portion and being able to reach out to our membership and provide that real data to CARB really does help make a difference. So just making sure that we're presenting this information, letting them know these assumptions that are being made aren't accurate for California.
I'm kind of curious why CARB, you know, opted to use the national numbers if they, I mean, they must have known that it's more of a generalization than it's not specific to the state. Why would they kind of misrepresent it like that?
So I don't necessarily know why their assumption was based off these sources, but I will say that it's just simply not accurate for us. So I can't say why it was used or what the reasoning was behind it, but I just know that it's not accurate for us, hence why we are now educating them on these are the real numbers that work for California.
Priscilla, my next question here, you talked about this a little bit already, but you know, there is a lower emissions rate that's being considered for rough terrain forklifts, commonly used by tree nut haulers. You know, how really, if you talk to the manufacturer or you kind of know what the manufacturer is offering, how feasible is that proposal? And is it nearly as severe as the electric mandate?
So there's a couple of things with this one. On the rough terrain forklift, as I mentioned, there was a manufacturer that spoke at a CARB workshop recently who said that they had this like super low emission rough terrain forklift. Now we still have to look into that. This is not something that I have vetted yet. So I can't say that it's something that exists per se. Obviously, we are not necessarily against lowering, if it's feasible, whenever this is feasible. If it is feasible, it makes sense, right? So even if you're talking about electric, if it's feasible and makes sense and it's cost effective, we are not against it, but it has to be feasible. So like I mentioned earlier, there's a manufacturer who's saying it. If it's feasible and it's something that can work, then absolutely we would be supportive of it. Obviously, there's no way to do an electric mandate on a rough terrain. So is it a severe? Well, it's not even a possibility there. Another thing that I would say is that at CARB's last workshop, they did also talk about exempting rough terrains from this proposal. So rough terrains could possibly be exempted. They did specifically say it was for outdoor operations on uneven grounds. So sometimes that verbiage or that language can be confusing. What does that mean, uneven grounds? Because in tree nets or hullers, it's not necessarily uneven grounds, but you do have gravel, you do have dirt, you do have mud. So those environments don't basically allow for anything besides rough terrain forklifts. So there's just some little nuances that do need to be corrected, but nonetheless, they have considered removing rough terrain forklifts from this proposal or on this mandate, which would be a great thing.
Maybe speaking on that consideration, they're making a little more, what do you think, maybe if you can speak on this, the chances of them doing that are at this point, what information does CARB need to see to maybe make that exemption?
I think we're getting a lot closer than we were in the initial discussions of it. They did include it, like I mentioned, they did in this last workshop, they did include rough terrain forklifts as an exemption on their proposal. So I think, like I said, it's just little small nuances on the uneven grounds or verbiage that probably needs to be removed or not limiting in terms of what rough terrain is, because some folks have different definitions of what rough terrain is. So I think this is something that can definitely be worked with CARB. I don't see that one being as large of an issue at this moment in time, just because they seem like they're moving forward on the right path with the rough terrain forklifts. So it seems to be going in the right direction, but we can never say it's a win until it's a win.
All right, Priscilla, we got time for one last question here. I do know that Western Ag Processors Association is pushing back against CARB. That's been pretty obvious to what you've been saying here. But, you know, what are you guys actually doing? And, you know, maybe how can producers help?
Obviously, one of the things that we did and we thought was the most important is making sure we had accurate data. So we did send out a survey out to our membership, getting accurate information on not just electric rates, but also cost and operation and maintenance of what it actually costs, because we do have some folks who have electric forklifts. So we wanted to get that difference, right? Propane versus electric, what's the difference? What's the operational cost? So getting that information, gathering it up and being able to provide that to CARB is going to be really important. So we did receive that information from membership and we're working to compile that information to be able to present to CARB. Now, in addition to that, we are also working with CARB and other ag stakeholders, and we'll be having a meeting here pretty soon in the near future to discuss where exactly ag is on this issue. In addition to that, we will be writing comments. We're in the process of writing comments right now to CARB with all the issues that we kind of described today, and letting them know what our issues are and why, and making that and writing that down. So that's kind of where we're at right now in the process. They are expected to come out with another workshop in October. So we continue pushing forward on this, continue having the dialogue with CARB and other ag stakeholders that make you sure we're in coordination for this effort.
I just want to ask one last little side question here with maybe some of the submissions that you guys have gotten from your members up to this point. I don't know if you can speak on this, but maybe what are the percentages of roughly some of your members that have electric forklifts to propane?
It's a little bit different because we have both processors and haulers. So in our haulers, hauling operations, it's not feasible to have, or it's less feasible to have electric. So those numbers aren't as high. But in our processing facilities, again, where it's feasible, you can see some processing facilities, a third of their fleet is electric or a quarter of their fleet is electric. So it really just depends on the operation, the type, the grounds, and whether or not it's feasible. So it really just depends and varies. But we've seen quite a bit of operations have both forklift and electric. Again, propane forklifts and electric forklifts, but propane is going to be the majority right now.
Well, this is obviously a serious issue coming amongst some of these other regulations for electric vehicles and agriculture at the moment. Hopefully, Western Ag Processors Association and CARB can come to some form of an agreement, or at least meet in the middle on this as it benefits haulers and sellers and other producers. Thank you, Priscilla, for coming on today and providing some insight on that.
You're welcome, Taylor. Is it okay to add something?
Yes.
Okay. So one of the things that I did want to add is, aside from what WAPA is doing right now, I think another thing that's important for us to work with on CARB is making sure that we create an incentive program around this as well, just like other incentive programs that have been for tractor, ATVs, ag pumps. So there have been very successful incentive programs that have helped both, you know, it's a dual process. So where it's CARB, the air district and agriculture working together to turn over those types of equipment. So something like that, some program like that, I think is going to be perfect or ideal when we're trying to talk about some type of a mandate for forklifts. So doing something of that nature is going to be key as well.
Okay. Well, we hope to see a program like that sooner on the horizon there. I think, you know, like you said, that could be really beneficial for maybe adopting some of these practices. Thank you for noting that and for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you, Taylor.
Of course. This is Taylor with My Ag Life.
That's our show for today. If there's a topic you'd like to hear more about, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Team. Thanks for listening.